And welcome again to Catholic Answers Focus. I am your host, Cy Kellett. And the more we consider it, the more remarkable the year 1917 seems on the 100th anniversary of that fateful year. We've already celebrated the apparitions of Mary at Fatima, Portugal, culminating on October 13th with the miracle of the sun, witnessed by 70,000 people or more. These apparitions were given in the very midst of what would become the deadliest revolution in history, the Russian Revolution, which gave rise to worldwide communist power. For a person of faith, it's very hard to avoid seeing profound connections between these events, a battle between the Queen of Heaven and the satanic forces. And I do mean satanic forces behind atheistic and murderous communism. Today, we discuss the events in Russia in 1917 with Paul Kengor, the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, and more recently, a pope and a president, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the extraordinary untold story of the 20th century. Paul Kengor, thanks for very much for being with us.
Sure, Cy. One of my favorite shows, Catholic Answers. Thank you.
Well, thanks. Thanks very much. I appreciate that. I should also mention that you are a professor at Grove City College in Grove City, Pennsylvania.
Correct.
Okay, so if you could help us, if we go back 100 years this month in October of 1917, what's happening in Russia?
Well, this was the launch of the internet of international communism, and it's appropriate that we use the number 100 because it also symbolizes not just 100 years, but about 100 million dead. I mean, communist governments would proceed to kill, be responsible for the deaths of, through execution, torture, concentration camps, Siberia, mass poverty, at least 100 million people. And you know, that number, Cy, that was used by, among others, in the classic Harvard University Press book, The Black Book of Communism, which came out at the end of the last century. And that figure it's also used by Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation, a number of others, but it's actually a conservative figure. If you go to the actual book, the Harvard University Press book, Black Book of Communism, the numbers for the deaths, the Soviet deaths, are only about 20 to 25 million. And the latest numbers on that, including Alexander Yakovlev, who was Mikhail Gorbachev's top reformer and the guy who in the 1990s was given the task of trying to actually calculate the number of people killed. He said that Stalin alone, quote, annihilated 60 to 70 million people. And the Black Book of Communism used a number for China, which was, I think, about 65 million people. The latest numbers on China look like maybe 70 to 80 million people. And the numbers on Korea in that list were short. I mean, that was It's probably a butcher's bill for North Korea, probably at least 5 million. So I know there's a lot of numbers here, but this could be as high as 140 million. And that would be far more. That would be double the combined death tolls of World War I and World War II.
And
that's pretty astonishing.
And it's necessary that we say, Paul, that these deaths that you're talking about are not war deaths of communists. This is not including communists started wars of aggression, or say throw the Vietnam War in there. These are murders.
That's right. And really, I mean, you could blame Stalin for a lot of the World War II deaths, because World War II was started by the Hitler-Stalin Pact, which was signed August 23rd, 24th, 1939. By their two foreign ministers, Molotov and Ribbentrop. Molotov for Stalin, Ribbentrop for Hitler. And that was where they agreed on the mutual invasion of Poland. That invasion took place the next week, September 1st, when the Germans invaded. And then the Soviets invaded 2.5 weeks later on September 17th, 1939. In fact, a lot of American communists who were Jewish left Communist Party USA over that. They were so furious with Stalin, with Stalin signing up with Hitler, that launched World War II and launched the Holocaust. And Nikita Khrushchev, who succeeded Stalin in his infamous Crimes of Stalin speech, you know, laying out what Stalin did, he blamed Stalin for a lot of the World War II deaths. So, I mean, you can go even further with this number. And while I'm at it, I got to mention this on a Catholic show. The Bolsheviks were the first major country to legalize abortion, and abortion got so out of control in the Soviet Union. This is astonishing. People listening, this is amazing. According to official Soviet statistics from the Soviet Health Ministry, they were averaging about 7 to 8 million abortions per year in the 1970s. 7 to 8 million per year. That right. dwarfs Roe v. Wade. So, I mean, you know, that would be, what, 70 to 80 million abortion deaths in one decade in the 1970s. So, I mean, the pile, the trail of blood by atheistic Soviet communism, it's quite literally hard to fathom and even calculate.
And so the October Revolution is the second revolution of 1917 in Russia, and we'll get to that. But by November 7th or 8th of 1917, the Bolsheviks, one of the two kind of communist parties of the time, have defeated the other party, which, if I'm recalling, was the Mensheviks, and now had seized power in Russia. And so this movement of worldwide communism that had been building in the world now had a major chunk of the world under its power. If we went back a year before that, so say October or November of 1916, was that a foreseeable outcome? Would people have said, oh, this is a genuine possibility that the Bolsheviks will have control of the whole thing?
No, and really, arguably, the only person or individual or entity, I should say, who foresaw it was Our Lady of Fatima. I mean, it was by February 1917. So February, March 1917 was kind of the first revolution in Russia that year. The Tsar abdicated in March of 1917. And then you had the Kerensky Provisional Government. And it was that that really enabled the Bolsheviks to eventually take power. But even then, I mean, no one saw that coming. February, March, April, I mean, nobody saw that coming.
Right.
And it was, in fact, here too, the Germans are to be blamed for a lot of this. The Germans, the government of Kaiser Wilhelm II, and specifically his right-hand man, his top general, Ludendorff, they allowed Lenin, who was in exile in Switzerland, they allowed him to get on a train in Switzerland and pass mm-hmm. through German territory. Lenin had been in exile. So, think about this, Cy, if I may be dramatic. I mean, this is like putting a neutron bomb on a boxcar and sending it into the middle of St. Peter's Square and detonating the thing. And they let Lenin loose, precisely the week in April 1917 when America joined World War I.
Yeah.
And the reason the Germans let Lenin through is because they realized that this plague bacillus, as Winston Churchill called him, right? this guy could take down the Russian government.
Right.
So and if this was short-sighted, the quote that Trotsky attributes to Ludendorff is that, well, Ludendorff, didn't you realize here that short-term gain, you could maybe win the war, but long time the Bolsheviks, you would get the Bolsheviks? Ludendorff supposedly said Lenin will defeat the Tsar. Lenin will take over, and then I will strangle Lenin. I will strangle him and all of his friends. So the Germans thought that they could contain this, but they couldn't.
And this is one of the striking things that Our Lady at Fatima is Pope Benedict said she was calling people back to the seriousness of life from the frivolity of the times. And that one of the things you see in the Russian Revolution, unless I'm mistaken, is that an enormous vanity of people who would not stop it. You mentioned Kerensky, who was a vain person himself. The Germans who were complicit in allowing this because I would even go further, if I may, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the entirety of World War I was very, very hard on Russian peasants. I mean, brutally hard. Millions, maybe 5 million Russian peasants killed, and really no concern from the leaders of Russia, including the Tsar and then others that followed, for the lives of these peasants. They were thrown in as fodder, as cannon fodder, essentially, to a war that even today we can't recall what the purpose of this war was. So it does seem that human vanity and grasping is at the root of allowing this satanic communist movement of getting a foothold.
That's exactly right. And Pope Benedict XV at the time declared it an unjust war. He said there's no good reason for the combatants to be fighting this. And you know, Cy, I've taught World War One for about 20 years now. It's the most frustrating war to teach because at the end of about two or three lectures of going through all the causes and so forth, which are colonial disputes, tariff disputes, the Balkans, and we talk about Gavrilo Princip, you know, firing the shot against Franz Ferdinand and his wife, the shot heard around the world. But there's no concentration camps. There's no Pearl Harbor. And the students will come away from it saying, I don't understand who the bad guy is, right? What's the evil here, right? What were we fighting for? And after all these years, it's not very clear. I know a lot of people don't even teach World War One, and I think they probably don't teach it in part because it's frustrating. But I will tell colleagues that you got to teach World War One because you can't understand the rest of the century without World War One. World War One gives us the Bolshevik Revolution. It gives us the rise of Hitler in Germany. And thus it leads to not only World War Two, but it also leads to the Cold War. So, I mean, that, you know, we are, World War One truly shaped the modern world.
And so this really shocking thing that seems almost to have a satanic power behind it, that is that amidst all this human vanity and the absolute mindlessness of this vast warfare and brutal warfare of World War One, there seems to be a guiding hand, I would say. I'm not going to put the words into your mouth, but what is suggested by all of this is a battle between Our Lady herself and Satan himself. And as you said, even months before the rise of the Bolsheviks, no one would have said that they're going to take power in Russia. And then this becomes you talk about the untold story of the 20th century in your book on Ronald Reagan and Pope John Paul II, that untold story being these two men saw themselves as engaged in not just a physical battle, but a battle on a deeper plane of for the very spirit of the world. That battle really is commenced in full force in October of 1917.
That's right. So really, it breaks out. The revolution officially breaks out, depending on the calendar you use, October 25th, 1917. So almost exactly 13 days after the final of the Marian apparitions, the miracle of the sun, October 13th, 1917. So maybe that was one more 13 that couldn't happen that year. Falls one day short of a full 13. It came October 25th. So it was, but it was within basically about 2 weeks after the final apparition. And, you know, these two... you mentioned the Bolsheviks and the Mensheviks. They had actually met back in January 1903, and they met in exile. And at that point in time, you know, people today, you know, listening out there who call themselves social democrats or democratic socialists, well, they were the Social Democratic Party of Russia. That's what they called themselves. So Lenin, Trotsky, and Stalin and all the others called themselves. And so they met in January 1903, and they split into the majority, the Bolsheviks, and the minority, the Mensheviks. But even then, you go from 1903 to about 1917, people didn't think the Bolsheviks were going to take over. I mean, they were just this nuisance. They were, people understand that they were barbarians. They were, even Woodrow Wilson, you know, the kind of progressive, understood how cancerous and destructive these guys were. I mean, he called them terrorists. You know, Woodrow Wilson realized, you know, these weren't, some people on the left, John Dewey, and others totally deluded. George Bernard Shaw, H.G. Wells, the head of the ACLU, Roger Baldwin, which was founded at that time, Margaret Sanger, who later made her own pilgrimage to the Soviet Union in 1934. I mean, a lot of these people were deluded, but Woodrow Wilson wasn't deluded, and neither was a young British naval officer named Winston Churchill, who was warning about him in 1919. But nobody, or entity, again, I'll use the phrase, called it as early as, I guess, the ultimate political, spiritual prognosticator here, a lady in Fatima.
It's striking, though, that if you had to say pick the evilest person in history, people would immediately say Adolf Hitler, the most evil regime in history. They'll say the Nazi Germans and the communists. Almost, I won't say they get a pass on their brutality, but it doesn't carry the infamy that Nazism does. Why is that?
Yeah, welcome to my world. This is my biggest complaint now for decades. And I saw this coming, and it's why today you'll see, for example, and I cite this in the, I cite all these studies, all these polls in the Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism. They, a disturbingly high number of Americans, thankfully it's not a majority, but of Americans across the board, not just millennials, I think it's close to a third, it's over a quarter, think that George W. Bush was responsible for more deaths than Joseph Stalin.
Oh, my Lord. So there's just no, they don't get this at all. And I have to say, some of the tool, the institutions of the Western world became kind of dupes themselves. I mean, you think about, I'm going to forget the name of the reporter for the New York Times who won a Pulitzer for reporting on the famines.
Walter Duranty.
And totally covered up Stalin's role in murdering the people of the Ukraine.
And that goes on to this day. I don't know if you saw a few weeks ago, but the New York Times has been running this Red Century series through 2017. And they had a piece, well, they had a piece about 2 months ago on how women had better sex under communism in the Soviet bloc. I can't make that up, right? And then they had a piece about 2 weeks ago on how communism in China made women's lives better, as it said. And it's just, I mean, if you read that article, it's horrific. I mean, it's really horrific. I wrote a piece on it for American Spectator. And they, you say, how could they do this? Well, they do what a lot of American people in the academy are doing and people writing the textbooks, too. Because I first saw this women, life is better for women under communism canard in high school textbooks that I was reviewing around the year 2000. But they cite basically that women were moved into the workforce, that they got the right to abortion, which I guess if you're a modern, you know, like secular progressive, there's no greater right. You know, forget about freedom of speech, press, assembly, religion, and private property. All a gal really needs is the right to abortion, right? They were given contraception. They were given education, and their children were taken care of in daycare centers. And so for all these reasons, these, it's kind of very odd, but a lot of these Western leftists are hailing communism as, well, yeah, maybe it killed, maybe 100 million people, but hey, women got the right to abortion.
Yeah.
They, their children were taken care of in daycare centers. And that article that was in the New York Times, there was no mention of the fact that China has a one-child policy. So if you're talking about women's reproductive freedom, I mean, even Hillary Clinton went, you know, condemned, went to Beijing and condemned that when she was first lady. They and you know, here's an amazing statistic, and this is very easily verifiable. This gets updated every single year. I've seen this for about 20 years now. China has about 20% of the world's women. So one out of every five women in the world are Chinese. China has 56% of the world's female suicides. According to the World Bank and World Health Organization, about 500 women commit suicide in China every day. Why? Because life for women under communism in China stinks. It's not good. It's lousy. It's terrible. And then, too, that doesn't even include female infanticide. You know, they're now looking at a women gap of like female gap of tens, if not hundreds of millions of women in China, because Chinese couples allowed to have one child more often than not, or oftentimes will abort the girl if she's identified as a female in ultrasound. And if they don't identify the girl in ultrasound and give birth to the girl, they'll drop the girl off under a bridge or at an orphanage, and they become wards of the state. I mean, this is no coincidence. Just look around. You and I both know couples who've adopted Chinese children. They're almost always girls. They're almost always girls. And, you know, that's just yet another horrific result. But it's, get it back to your original point. This is not taught in the academy. And, you know, the New York Times is, you know, the newspaper of record for the kind of American secular progressives. Right. Give us a day, our New York Times. I mean, that, you know, that's where they go. And if the Times reports it, it's like gospel truth to them.
Well, it's 100 years of the New York Times covering up or at least coddling communism. I mean, a shocking thing to me is Walter Duranty's Pulitzer is still counted among the Pulitzers won by the New York Times. They have never given it back. They've never, even though they know that it was a lie that covered up the murder of millions of people, they didn't give it back.
Yeah, that's right. And really, I find it perfectly fitting that the newspaper of Walter Duranty would be running articles like this about Chinese communism on the 100th anniversary. No, it's really scandalous. And I like the way that you put this about coddling, or it's not necessarily that they are it's not that they're communists, right?
Right.
The New York Times, and, you know, people on the right will say that all the time, you know, call it a communist. They're secular progressive. And they share or laud or applaud a lot of the goals of communists: workers' rights, pushing women out into the workforce, first nation in the world, right? Bolshevik Russia to legalize abortion. They like that, right?
Yeah.
Redistribution of wealth, economic equality, you know, taking from the rich and giving to the poor. So they like those things. And often, too, what you'll find, sometimes it's a soft pro-communism. And at the very least, and I think this is really important, Robert Conquest of the Hoover Institution used to make this point. Richard Pipes at Harvard used to make this point. It's not what they are is kind of anti-communist.
Yes, right.
Right. They don't like the anti-communists. They see anti-communists like me as, you know, kind of unsophisticated, right. Boorish, a little Neanderthal, right? A little right. Rough around the edges. It reminds them of
Joe McCarthy.
It's tacky. Yeah, it's like FDR saying to Martin Dies, who was a Democrat, the first head of the Dies Committee, which became the House Un-American Activities Committee. He said, Martin, you see a bugaboo under every bed, don't you?
Yeah.
A bugaboo under every bed. And he said, Eleanor and I, we have lots of friends who are communists. We know good people who are communists. And in fact, FDR said the exact same thing to a visiting Secretary of State from the Vatican in 1936 named Eugenio Pacelli, who became Pope Pius XII. I tell the story in A Pope and a President, and Pacelli said to FDR, he said, Mr. President, you do not understand the communist threat. And FDR said to him the same thing he said to Martin Dies. He said, Mr. Secretary, no, it's the fascists that you have to watch out for.
Right.
It's the Nazis. I know people who are communists. I'm telling you, they're not that bad.
Right.
So they have this blind spot toward communism. They really do. And also, I'm sorry, I'm going on about this, but they go after extremists on the right in so much as they see them on the right, in so much the Nazis are even on the right. We could have that debate. But they don't see the extremists on their far left.
Right.
You know, James Burnham, the great ex-communist, said, for the left, the preferred enemy is always to the right. So they hear a Donald Trump condemning both sides in Charlottesville, and they say, well, how can that be? There's only neo-Nazis there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no. They were far left and far right. They were both there. Nah, how could that be? They don't see it. It's a total blind spot.
Well, I wonder if sometimes there's a sense of – well, no, I don't wonder about this. I know that this is the case because people will say it. But that it's true that, you know, Stalin took over after Lenin and Trotsky. But if it had been left up to Lenin and Trotsky and a more democratic kind of communism had been allowed to flourish and it hadn't become this dreaded dictatorship, then it could have worked. It's just that it got hijacked by a brutal figure like Joseph Stalin.
Yeah, that we used to call that the good Lenin, bad Stalin myth.
Yeah.
And it's been pretty obliterated now, even in the academy. I mean, people realize that it was Lenin who established the one-party state, you know, who built the gulags, which, by the way, Lenin and Trotsky called those concentration camps. You know, they were using the term concentration camp before the Nazis were. You know, he created the one-party state, banned all civil liberties, you know, abortion. Like I said, that was started under him in 1920. In fact, by the way, Stalin actually stopped abortion in 1936 because he said, if this keeps up, we're not going to have a country left. I mean, the abortion rate here is just so out of control. We're not going to. And Trotsky reprimanded him on this from abroad. He was in exile. He's like, no, you cannot be a good communist and ban abortion. Right. Yeah. Lenin and Trotsky were bad. Lenin was a monster. In fact, Lenin was, I think, even more hateful and vitriolic and nasty. And we have more of a paper trail of Lenin's vicious, violent language from Lenin than we do Stalin. So, no, Lenin, as one historian said, the Soviet Union would have founded Stalin in any event because Lenin had already set the system up.
And yet we can, in a way that cannot happen with Nazis, and we've picked on the New York Times, I'd like to pick on Hollywood for a minute. You can have the glorification.
Me too. Good.
You can have the kind of glorification of people like, you know, Diego Garcia and Frida Kahlo welcoming Trotsky in Mexico, or Dalton Trumbo standing up to these anti-communist rubes and that kind of thing. We still today, or don't even start with Che Guevara, a murderer and a torturer and a killer of children. These people can, there's some way in which it's still okay to glorify these figures.
Yeah, that's right. And in the Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism, I list the 10 Communist Party USA numbers for all members of the Hollywood 10. Dalton Trumbo, John Howard Lawson, Albert Maltz, all of them. All 10 out of 10 of the Hollywood 10 were Communist Party USA members. And we knew that in 1947. We had their numbers at the time. They were published by the time, at the time, by Congress. So we knew this. They were all guilty. They had swore a loyalty oath to Stalin's Soviet Union when they joined, you know, pledged to a Soviet America, as William Z. Foster, the head of Communist Party USA, called it. Get his book. It's called Toward Soviet America. That's what they called it. Or as Langston Hughes put it, put one more S in the USA, make it the USSA.
Oh,
he said that's what it'll be. Yeah, that's what it'll be when we take over. Yeah, so that's true. And also, I mean, I could go on. You give me another half an hour and I can go on about Che Guevara. He was a bloodthirsty, sadistic murderer who personally did executions himself, ran Fidel's execution squads, his execution pits. And also, Che actually wanted to fire at the United States, as did Fidel in October 1962. The missiles in the Cuban Missile Crisis. So the main reason the Khrushchev got those missiles out of there was he realized, wow, these two guys are insane.
Right.
They actually want to use the missiles. And he called a late Sunday night meeting at the Kremlin and said, get them out. Get the missiles out. Get them out now. Get them out. Get them out. Get them out. These guys are crazy. And here we are in America today where Che is a brand. And you've got college students actually walking around wearing T-shirts with the guy's face on the T-shirt. It's amazing.
And they just made a very celebratory movie about Dalton Trumbo not very long
ago. They did. It's really sad that those are Hollywood's icons. Maybe they'll make one about Walter Duranty next.
Yeah, well, they've got their own problems with Harvey Weinstein and all that this week. But when they get over that, as soon as they go back to congratulating themselves for standing up to Joe McCarthy. But it can't all be a bad story, though, because as we said, just weeks before the Bolsheviks really, in a satanic way, miraculous revolution, take over Russia and begin the Soviet Union. Just weeks before that, Our Lady has concluded her time at Fatima. She's given us a program for spiritual battle for the century. So can you say something about on this 100th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution, how in the end was it defeated?
Well, and let me say too that if there's an ongoing message of Fatima, it's this call for conversion and repentance. And yes, I would say that it was fulfilled, right? The battle of the 20th century to stop the Bolshevik errors and crimes, as Our Lady had forewarned. And it was stopped by a number of people. I mean, I always name a half a dozen, several different people. I'd say Ronald Reagan and John Paul II were the top two. And to that, I would add Mikhail Gorbachev, Margaret Thatcher, Lech Walesa, Vaclav Havel, Boris Yeltsin. I'd add the Solidarity Movement, even groups like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, which, you know, with our Stinger missiles and so forth, you know, defeated the Soviets on the ground, or at least drove them off of Afghan territory. So all of those things were absolutely crucial. But if Fatima kind of lives on in one sense, beyond this general call to conversion and repentance, it's that the crimes of communism are not over. I mean, China is still politically communist and
yes.
You know, still has that. Actually, they've gone to a two-child policy now, but they're still controlling women's reproduction. They still have massive abortion. Look at Cuba. Look at places like Venezuela, where what they're calling 21st century socialism really looks a lot like, you know, 20th century communism.
Mm-hmm.
And look above all at North Korea. If we do finally end up, you know, in the big one with a nuclear exchange, and nuclear holocaust, you know, with the communists, the one that everybody was worried about in the 20th century that didn't happen with the Soviets, it may well happen with North Korea. And so that is the most Stalinist state ever. In fact, the Kims have out-Stalined Stalin. Even Stalin didn't have that kind of a personality cult and you know, kind of deistic totalitarian state going on. So in that sense, a lot, you know, the message of Fatima in that sense continues.
I wonder if here in America, as much as we, you know, we can, there were communists here, and we talk about the institutions that kind of coddled and covered up for, or even glorified communists in a way. There was never a serious communist party in the United States, and I wonder if you could speculate on why that was.
At the peak of its membership in the 1930s, we think it was no more than 100,000 people. And so in that sense, yeah, never really got very, very serious. The bigger concern was probably people on the wider left that communists concealing their identity and their motivations and intentions were able to push their buttons, you know, were able to dupe, you know, to use the phrase common of the day. You know, Lenin referred to such people on the left as useful idiots. And they found a lot of them on the religious left in particular, the way that they were able to use so-called agents of influence. And the way, you know, to again mention Martin Dies in his conversation with FDR, Martin Dies said, "Mr. President, we've got data here on literally, you know, over 1,000 communists in the federal government's machinery at the very top levels." He's telling that to him in the 1930s and 1940s. And you know, we now know today through the Venona papers and so forth, that was absolutely accurate.
Right.
But to have somebody like FDR shrug it off, "Oh, come on, Mr. Congressman Martin, Eleanor and I have a bunch of friends who are communists. I can control these people. I know them. It's okay." Well, to the extent that they could conceal and manipulate through disinformation and manipulation, that's how they were very successful. And even today, again, I'll point back to Charlottesville. When I saw what happened in Charlottesville, I immediately thought of Antifa, and I immediately thought of the group RevCom, which is Revolutionary Communist Party USA. Because of what I do, I have to check the websites of these people. Revolutionary Communist Party USA is always at all these different racial incidents and rallies trying to stir the pot. And all you need is 20 people, yeah, and TV cameras, and you can have the White House get involved, the New York Times, CNN, everybody else. So today, in a way, they can oddly be more influential than ever because of the power of social media and technology. And I think we're seeing that right now.
I suppose part of the subtext for my question is that, you know, the Knights of Columbus became famously anti-communists, and Protestants, mainline Protestants and non-denominational or evangelical fundamentalist Protestants across the country were strongly anti-communist. And with the rise of religious non-affiliation in the United States, young people who do not feel themselves to have any connection to Christ or the church in any way, in your view, does that make us more vulnerable to ideologies such as communism maybe arising here?
Well, I think it does, and especially because a lot of them are calling themselves socialists and not realizing that socialism, according to Marxist theory, is just a transitory transitional phase on the way to full communism. And in fact, USSR, the second S in USSR, was socialist, and communists would often call themselves socialists. But among the survey data that I give in the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide, something like 69% of millennials, and this was, I think, done 2 years ago, I got the exact citation in the book, but 69% of millennials said that they would vote for a socialist for president of the United States. Now, if people are like, that wouldn't really happen, well, about a year after that, Bernie Sanders, a lifetime self-avowed socialist, the most far-left member of the Senate, to the left of Barbara Boxer, Dick Durbin, Hillary Clinton, Ted Kennedy, everybody. I mean, Bernie's always been, you know, kind of the opposite end of the poll, you'd say, well, the most you got like Jesse Helms kind of on the right. And then on the left, you got kind of Ted Kennedy, Hillary Clinton. Then you got Bernie Sanders. Whoa, way to the left, right?
Yeah.
Well, that guy got 13 million votes in the Democratic primary.
Yeah.
And, you know, to give you a sense of perspective, Donald Trump got 14 million in the Republican primary. And that's a record in the Republican primary. So he was just right behind Trump, and he wasn't far behind Hillary. Hillary got 17 million. And they're convinced, you know, some of the Bernie people, that if it wasn't for shenanigans of Team Hillary, that they would have actually won the nomination. So we're seeing this now in how people are not just the things people are believing and saying, but how they're voting.
I do think that the myth of untried communism, however, well, real communism hasn't really been tried, is part of. I mean, these young people, they're not bad people. They certainly have been experienced miseducation on this point. And among that is this idea that, well, it has never really been tried. I mean, you can't count Russia and, you know, the 80 other times it was tried. Those don't count. We would do it right if we did it.
Yeah, they believe that. They say that all the time. I quote James Kirchick in the book. He's from the Daily Beast. He's a liberal. He's an anti-communist liberal. And he said how many times he's heard this from fellow liberals that, you know, quote, communism isn't responsible for all these deaths. Crappy leaders were. And Kirchick says, right. And he says, well, you know, how many crappy leaders do you have before you realize it's the ideology? And I mean, you think about this, it's not just like, well, you know, Russians are a little authoritarianism. So communism hit there. And I'm not surprised this happened in Russia. OK, well, how about Cuba? How about Cambodia? How about China? How about East Germany?
Right.
How about Bulgaria? Just go around the world, wherever it's tried. It ends up at the very least in starvation and queues and shortages and repression of basic civil liberties. And far too often it leads to mass slaughter on a scale completely unprecedented and unseen in the history of any of those countries, let alone continents. So no, it's not crappy leaders. It's the crappy ideology that's killing people. But they don't connect the two. And in part because, here again, poor education. They're not learning this stuff K through 12, and they're certainly not learning it at our horrible universities where a lot of Catholics who are watching this right now are probably sending their kids. And if you're sending your kids to one of those colleges, shame on you. You're paying for that college to teach this stuff to your kids. You don't need to do that. Go to the National Catholic Register list or the Newman list. There's some good colleges out there. You know, stop sending your kids to these schools. And then when you do, don't send me an email saying you were right. I can't believe what happened. Wow. Just 4 months later, after leaving our house, freshman year, comes back at Christmas time. She's declared herself a boy. She supports Planned Parenthood and she's planning to vote for the socialists. I'm telling you, it happens all the time. I get so sick of her. Oh, he'll be fine. She'll be fine. Went to religious ed. Don't do it. Please stop.
Right. The young minds are open in a way that makes them wonderful, but also vulnerable. And so you're
overwhelmed.
Yeah, right. Indeed.
They're only 18.
Yeah. Paul Kengor is the author of A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century. Also the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Communism on this 100th anniversary of one of the most remarkable years ever, 1917, both for positive things such as the apparitions at Fatima and for extraordinarily negative things, including the madness of World War I and the murderousness and in the rise of world communism. Paul Kengor, thanks so much for being with us to discuss it.
Sure thing, Cy. Anytime. Thanks.
I just don't think we could have had a better guest to walk us through all of that. Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. Please tell your friends. We do this all the time. And I can't say that they're all as good as Paul Kengor, but they're pretty good. So tell your friends about Catholic Answers Focus. We'll see you next time.